So yeah, I guess now it's time to talk about my top five Japanese movies that made me.
Run down the list.
I'm going to do this in the order in which I saw them and they impacted me in my brain
like a diamond bullet in your brain, as Quentin Tarantino said about something. Anyway.
Well, speaking of Tarantino, number one is Shogun Assassin, 1980, the US adaptation of the Lone Wolf and Cub movies. So it's like the first 10 minutes of the first Lone Wolf and Cub movie and then pretty much all of the second one, Baby Cart at the River Styx.
Right.
So this was just back in the day, you know, at the video rental store. There's a videotape from MCA Home Video called Shogun Assassin, big bloody font, a picture of a samurai, kind of looked like John Belushi doing the samurai delicatessen routine.
Right.
Pushing a baby cart with a little kid. And I'm like, hey, I'm a little kid. This looks great. And I wasn't quite prepared for the carnage that ensued.
Return to the vanished kingdoms of ancient times. Journey through a lost empire of mad wizards and barbaric passions. Behold the saga of a legendary warrior, a loving father, who has the power of a dozen armies in one sweep of his mystic blade. This is a story of honor, disgrace, vengeance, massacre, and a man who became a demon, Shogun Assassin. Once, he was the greatest of the magnificent samurai. Now, he hunts the evil lords who butchered his wife and stained his honor. One man and one child defy the most notorious masters of death on the planet. Like father, like son. Meets the greatest team in the history of mass slaughter.
Not the first samurai movie I'd seen. For some reason, my parents took me to see Yojimbo versus Zatoichi.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, I don't know what they were thinking, but they did like a lot of foreign films. But this one was felt like it was made for me because it was so gory. Jesus Christ, man. It was like Dawn of the Dead.
Although, like, can we just say, the blood looks like paint. I always really loved it in those. Like, the blood is like super, super paint-like. I think it's great. I think it improves the experience. It always felt a little theatrical to me, although as a kid, I was like, this is so realistic, man.
This is like something out of a comic book. And it was. It was based on the manga by Kazuo Koike.
One of the first to come to the States, actually, although much after Shogun Assassin came to theaters.
It's a grindhouse adaptation. It was distributed by Roger Corman's New World Pictures.
Right.
And one of the funnest things I ever wrote was doing an oral history of Shogun Assassin, where I had to track down the director, the script writer, the producer, and even the guy who did the voice of Baby Daigoro.
That's in Tokyo Scope, right?
That's all in Tokyo Scope. Maybe I'll put that up on Substack.
You should. It's amazing. I remember that was one of my favorite parts of that book. The other thing I remember about this movie is that it came out, it being named Shogun, like, just so dates it. Like, you had Shogun the miniseries, which obviously spawned this, the Shogun Warriors, like the toy series.
Imagine you enter the world of the Shogun Warriors. They're on the move. There's Raideen with delta-winged missiles, Dragoon with a star shooter, and Mazinga with a rocket launcher. The Shogun! Imagine you command them to defend freedom, protect justice, and challenge evil. The Shoguns! They're ready to strike when you are. Shogun Warriors, Mazinga, Dragoon, Raideen, equipped with their own gear, each sold separately from Mattel.
Everything was named Shogun in the late 70s. It's just such a moment in time, you know?
A million bad sub-Benihana steakhouses were called the Shogun Steakhouse and stuff like that. That really gave me a taste for sort of like the violent world of Jidaigeki, although there's not that many Japanese sword movies that are quite as bloody and violent that really have that much of a body count.
No. I mean, Hanzo the Razor is kind of a little bit, but it's a little bit more focused on sexual harassment, to put it mildly.
So number two is, I don't necessarily seem like a Kurosawa guy, but I do have a big sweet tooth for his later big budget spectacle historical films, and it's Ron from 1985.
Based on Shakespeare no Macbeth.
King Lear.
Yes.
So Ron was like given a prestige release in the US. It was widely shown at like art theaters when they still used to have those in America, and was seen as like, you know, a defining work by like the master director who had already made his name with things like Rashomon, Seven Samurai, and even Kagemusha. I'd never seen anything like Ron before. The artistry, the color. I know some people prefer like black and white Kurosawa. It's got like a noirish kind of edge to it. Like Ikkyu, I think, is like one that's kind of gone up in terms of prestige. But Ron is just a feast for the eyes, and those battle scenes, man. Like, it's not that dissimilar from Shogun Assassin. Like, no spoilers, but a few characters lose their heads, so to speak. And you do get the big old bright red paint blood spray. And you see people looking like human pin cushions wandering around battlefield.
Life was tough back then.
Life was tough back then in the era of the Warring States. So I loved Ron as like human drama, because of course the acting is amazing, like Tatsuya Nakadai as the King Lear-like figure. Amazing performances in it, and the battle scenes are just the cherry on the top. So if I want to watch a Kurosawa movie, I usually go straight for the Ron.
Well, my understanding is that didn't Kurosawa, he couldn't get funding for the film in Japan, and it had to get like go to France, I believe, to get the money to do it.
That sounds about right, because that happened to him with Kagemusha, and he got the money from Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas.
Yes, and by the way, and just as an aside, I do agree that Ron is the better film of the two, but Kagemusha is really, really interesting. If you like ninja, it has the most realistic portrayal of ninja I've ever seen in a Japanese movie. They're all dressed like farmers and like just running around listening and like running back and telling their masters like what they saw on the battlefield. Like none of this American impression, like black body stockings and like ninja stars, just people running around.
There's no one with a Garfield phone like saying they have to rebuild the ninja empire.
Listen to me, traitor. I believe that you've received a death message from our ninja empire. Ninja is supreme and you have double-crossed it. Why did you do that?
The ninja empire is evil. I have to reform the ninja empire. That is why I took away the golden ninja warrior.
You've got 3 days in which to return the golden ninja warrior, or else you die.
Go to hell.
Another quick anecdote about Ron is I remember Kurosawa, an interview with him where he's being asked like, Mr. Kurosawa, how did you come up with these framings and these angles? And he's like, well, there was like a power line like there. I had to put the camera. He's filming it in Japan. Like there's no place in Japan that actually looks like Ron looks. Like he had to really, really hunt all over Japan to find like enough open space to get like the battle scenes and things like that. This is exactly why Last Samurai went to like New Zealand to film. You just can't do it. So like he was like really constrained by where he could put the camera angles and stuff, and it turned out to be really cool.
I love Kagemusha too. I actually watched it again not too long ago, and it's all fantastic, but the battle scenes don't really have the impact. Like I feel like it's like a dress rehearsal for what he wanted to do in Ron. Ron to me feels like an entire lifetime spent making films. Like a guy gets to make his crazy dream project, gets to set the castle on fire, gets to use the big wide angle lens and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that depiction of sort of like people using firearms like back in the day is like so incredible. So you have like flintlocks versus samurai swords is basically what they should have called it when they showed it at the drive-in.
Which is real. That really happened. And it didn't go well for the first samurai who ran into the guys with the flintlocks. Yes, classic, classic, classic film. Just really amazing. But it doesn't have any ghosts or yokai in it, so I couldn't pick it. I'm glad you did.
Number three is Street Mobster, also known as Gendai Yakuza Hitokiri Yota, which is from 1972. It's a Yakuza movie directed by Kenji Fukasaku, one of the great Japanese movie directors, okay? And the thing about Kenji Fukasaku is he directed one of my favorite movies of all time, Message from Space. He also directed The Green Slime. Like, I knew his name. I knew his fame. I knew he had directed a bunch of great Yakuza movies that were almost impossible to see in the, like, late 90s, early 2000s, unless you could find a Japanese video store that had them. And one day, one opened in San Francisco. People Video. They had a wall and it was filled with Yakuza movies. And I was like, oh boy, I was in heaven, pig and slop. First one I picked was Street Mobster. And it's just Bunta Sugawara from one of your favorite movies, The Man Who Stole the Sun, as a chimpira, kind of the lowest level Yakuza foot soldier working for Noboru Ando, the real life gangster Yakuza guy who became a movie star.
Such a crazy story.
Just causing havoc, chaos. At one point, he throws a bowl of ramen at someone, which is the most chimpira thing I can think of. It's yes. narrated by Bunta Sugawara, and it's just like a mad dog, lowlife, on the run kind of movie, but you hate to see him go. You know this is going to end badly for all concerned. Just a lean, mean Yakuza movie. Like, obviously, Fukusaku would scale up and deliver like the Battles Without Honor and Humanity Yakuza films, which are kind of like equivalent to The Godfather, but this is just his down and dirty, like mean streets.
I don't actually know this one. I don't know anything about it except the names of the people involved. You've convinced me. I'm going to watch this.
I think Arrow Video, like recently someone put it out again on DVD, Blu-ray globally, but I think you can probably find it at any decent Tsutaya in Japan or watch it via streaming.
I'm just looking. I just looked this up on Wikipedia and just one line, Okita loses his mind and attacks. Like I see this one like line. I'm like, oh, okay. This is good. So it's fun for the whole family. Is that what you're saying?
Fun for the whole family. So the next time you have a yen for a Yakuza movie, check out Street Mobster.
I got that reference.
Number four, Dead or Alive by Takashi Miike, 1999.
That is a messed up movie in so many ways. I mean that as high praise, but you go, please go on.
Well, I mean, Street Mobster, the film I just talked about, was, you know, example of a Yakuza movie from the 1970s, which was like shown in movie theaters, you know, in actual real deal grindhouses. But by the late 1990s, Yakuza cinema had largely become V cinema, direct to video Yakuza movies. And there were some good and there were some bad. And Takashi Miike, this kind of young up and coming director, made the crazy ones. I guess he kind of began getting attention with something like Fudo, which was kind of like his teenage Yakuza high school 90210 movie. But Dead or Alive was kind of like his cop versus criminal movie.
Yes.
The opening 10 minutes of Dead or Alive, some of the most insane kaleidoscopic. It's really Miike announcing, we're going to go nuts. You know, I'm going to take you by the hand. You're going to understand how crazy Shinjuku Kabukicho is. I mean, just on the surface, I think the movie was kind of designed to be like a copy of Heat, the Michael Mann movie. But Miike kind of put it through the Miike blender and added that amazing beginning sequence. And then, of course, the ending, which I don't want to spoil. But this was the arrival of Miike onto the world stage as a dangerous filmmaker, an outlaw master.
Was this before or after Audition?
I think it was the same year.
God, wow. What a year. Because it's 99, right? Yeah, it is the same year. Was he filming these like back to back? That is such a crazy like a pair of movies. So like Audition came out in October of 99 and Dead or Alive came out, God, in November. Can you imagine having two major films come out like 1 month after each other? That's insane.
Well, here's the thing. I think I've told this story before, is I was at the Rotterdam International Film Festival. Miike was there. No one knew who he was. And he had two films booked into the festival, Dead or Alive and Audition.
Oh my
and so
God.
That's when I first saw Dead or Alive. And I was like, oh my goodness. So we ran to interview him, did a big interview with Miike. And he said, yeah, check out my movie tomorrow night. It's called Audition. It's the first time it's going to screen before an international audience. Let me know what you think. And that was one of the most bananas movie screenings I've ever seen in my life, because I've never seen like 80% of an audience get up and run as fast as they can.
It was shocking. Dead or Alive to me is like a comedy almost. Like, it's not funny, but it's hugely satirical and funny, right?
And it's absurdist. Yeah.
Absurdist. Yes. It's almost like surrealist. It's just, it's insane. Audition starts out as like a completely normal, even boring seeming like Japanese drama of the kind that's shown regularly all over Japan, featuring like a lonely guy who's looking for a new wife or girlfriend or whatever. And you're like, oh, what a snoozer. And then it just goes off the rails. It just completely goes off. So to me, he's always been the master of the switcheroo.
In the sense that you think Dead or Alive is just going to be like another straight to video Yakuza movie. And then he punches you as hard as he can in the face, like the second the movie starts. Whereas Audition is the slow burn. And yeah, by the ending, you're tied up and someone's cutting you up bit by bit.
No spoilers. See them, seriously. See Dead or Alive. Make sure the kids are in bed. Don't show these films to people with fragile, you know, still developing. Otherwise, they'll turn out like us. Okay. So just be very careful. If you let your children see films like this, 30 years from now, they're going to be doing a podcast like this and you're going to be crying.
And my final film is one that I saw maybe only like for the first time 7 or 8 years ago. It's called Utamaro's World from 1977.
Wow. Okay.
Directed by Akio Jisoji. Okay. This is one I was not expecting. expecting to hit me upside the head. So Akio Jisoji is most famous for directing a bunch of episodes of Ultraman. And he had a background as like an experimental art film director. And he brought this incredible camera work, this hyper-modernity to Ultraman that basically, if you've seen Shin Ultraman and they start doing like crazy camera angles, that is Jisoji. That's a direct copy, homage, whatever you want to call it. So Jisoji, one of the great Japanese experimental tokusatsu film directors of all time, was given a big budget in 1977 to make an erotic movie, like in the mold of like Last Tango in Paris, about the life of pornographic ukiyo-e artist Utamaro Kitamura.
Okay, I will inject here. Utamaro was not only a pornographic artist, he's actually most famous for doing the big portrait style head imagery of geisha. He was doing these at the turn of the 1800s, so early 1800s. He created a fad for these like prints of like just portraits of geisha, and like those later influenced like French and like European impressionists. They made like a huge impression on him. But he did do porny stuff too, and he actually famously got thrown in jail by the Tokugawa authorities.
Well, there you go, because that's the part of his life that this movie focuses on, his pornographic era and his trouble with the cops. And the reason why it's such an amazing movie is the movie's good. It's okay. It's not my favorite Jisoji live action movie. It's not as far out and as surreal as some of his other films are. Actually, someone did a box set of Jisoji's, I think it was Arrow Video, of his art films, his 60s art films.
Oh, wow.
Which has, who's the girl from the Science Patrol and Ultraman?
Oh, yeah. Sakurai, Hiroko Sakurai.
You get to see a different side of Hiroko Sakurai than you've ever seen before in some of those films. Let me just say that.
It's okay.
Nicely camped. Anyway, Utamaro's World has an amazing soundtrack by this guy named Ryohei Hirose, who's like a contemporary Japanese classical composer. And I think the movie is about a, you know, I give it like a B minus as a watch, but that soundtrack is like an A+++++. And it's kind of jazz funk with traditional sort of Japanese arrangements and instruments. And it's not like that cheesy kabuki rock kind of sound.
Right.
It's incredibly tasteful, incredibly groovy. And the thing was, the soundtrack was never digitally released on compact disc. It was LP only.
Oh, wow. Did you find it?
I did. So that's the reason I got back into vinyl, Matt, because I had to have that soundtrack.
That you had to have the soundtrack to a pornographic woodblock print movie?
It's very tasteful, Matt. It's very artistic.
Utamaro, to me, the reason I know Utamaro, just besides the fact that he's just a famous, famous printmaker, is he studied under Toriyama Sekien, who is the guy who, in the 1770s, painted the first yokai encyclopedia, which Hiroko and I translated a few years back and published under the name Japandemonium Illustrated. So Utamaro spent his like apprenticeship and like his youth studying under this master of some of the most grotesque and awesome Japanese spooky yurei yokai art, like the undisputed master. Actually, in Japandemonium Illustrated, he mentions Utamaro in there, talking about the big head prints that he was already getting famous for making. Now I really want to see this. Utamaro is just such an amazing, you know, artist. Like Hokusai gets all the attention, but Utamaro is really amazing too. So
yeah, the whole film is on YouTube. I'll put a link in the
really?
Show
really. Oh, that's cool.
Just hearing that music there is not enough. I had to have the vinyl LP, and I think as the curtain closes on our top Japanese movies that made us, I'm going to play a little bit of the soundtrack of Utamaro's World.
Thank you.
Well, Matt, that about wraps it up for several episodes of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast.
This was a real marathon recording session, but I'm glad we did it because it was like sneaking into the movies all over again, except in our minds and hearts.
I'm trying to think what else we could do. Things that made us. The tonkatsu that made us. The yakisoba that made us.
The erotic woodblock prints that made us. The smells in the stairwell of Shibuya Mandarake that made us.
Something like that. But in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. Continue to listen. Continue to spread the word.
Yes. And please check out both of our Substacks. Mine is at blog.pureinventionbook.com. Patrick's is at
tokyoscope.blog.
Easier to remember, but just as fun to read. Thanks for listening and catch you next time.
Catch you next time. Bye.